Where are all these serious Democrats, who believe in civil liberties? I don't agree with Rand Paul on much in the world, but the fact that it's someone like him doing it instead of Democrats who spent so much time under the Bush era condemning these very same things says a lot about how bankrupt Congress is on this and other issues.
Hi, I'm Matt Welch for Reason TV. I'm joined today by Jeremy Scahill. He's the foreign policy correspondent for The Nation and author of a troubling new book called Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. There's also a new IFC documentary of the same name, Dirty Wars, in which he is sort of the lead protagonist, showing us about how American foreign policy is being conducted right now. Jeremy, thank you very much.
Great to be with you.
Joining us. You write in the book, most people know about the authorization of military force on September 14th, which was signed into law on September 18th. You say there was another, more secretive finding signed into law on September 17th, 2001, that is even more momentous. Tell us about that.
Right. You know, I mean, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld in particular came into office with an agenda. I mean, they, of course, had no way of knowing that 9/11 was going to happen, but they really wanted to conduct what Rumsfeld called a revolution in military affairs and to transform the way that the U.S. military operated around the world. And those guys, and also President Obama views this the same way, sort of saw the executive branch as operating a dictatorship when it came to national security policy. Cheney sort of viewed Iran-Contra not as a scandal, but as the model for how U.S. foreign policy should be waged. And so when 9/11 happened, they sort of already had their hands on the levers and started to issue a series of secret presidential directives that would authorize the CIA and U.S. Special Operations Forces to conduct what are called kinetic operations, either kill or capture operations, in a variety of countries around the world, and to have minimal to no congressional oversight. So they started a program called Greystone, which the abbreviation for it was GST internally. And that was the umbrella under which many of what are now viewed as the more unsavory things that were done during the Bush era were conducted. The black sites of the CIA were set up, the use of waterboarding and other torture techniques, and the snatching of people from countries both in declared battlefields, such as Afghanistan, or other countries around the world. And basically, they created an archipelago of black sites, interrogation centers, and started to develop alternative legal reasoning for prosecuting what they started to call a global war against terrorism or a global war on terror.
Now, part of this was to remove the usual functions of oversight. There had been snatch operations before. There had even been sort of assassination authority that was very seldom used.
Yeah.
So walk us through what changed from a legal point of view.
Well, you'll remember that Gerald Ford was the first president to put on the books a ban or a supposed ban on assassination. And it's not that Ford was some great opponent of assassination. It's that there was this scandalous period where the CIA had been involved with a number of coups, with various targeted killing operations, with overthrowing democratically elected governments, supporting juntas, and there were very aggressive congressional investigations. The Church Committee, former Senator Frank Church of Idaho, and others aggressively going after Congress. And so Ford, coming out of the Nixon era, decided that he was going to issue an order saying that it's the policy of the United States that we do not conduct assassinations. And every president since has updated or renewed some version of that executive order. Congress has never passed a law saying that the United States doesn't assassinate. And the reason is Congress doesn't want to take up that question. Every president from Ford to the present has engaged in something that I think reasonable people could argue is an assassination. President Clinton was directly targeting Saddam Hussein's palaces. President Reagan attempted to kill Gaddafi. President Bush, George W. Bush, was involved in all sorts of targeted killing operations that they refused to call assassinations. So you had this this era preceding 9/11 where every president sort of found a way around it. Congress didn't want to take up the question. Under President Clinton, and a lot of liberals don't like to talk about this, that's when the rendition program was started. Clinton was the first president to really create a policy framework for snatching people in countries and not sending them to CIA black sites, sending them to Hosni Mubarak's Egypt or Assad's Syria, or in some cases, Gaddafi's Libya, where people could be interrogated, sometimes with US personnel in the room. And it was a way of saying, we're not doing this, but we're facilitating or aiding other governments in their fight against terrorism or extremism. When 9/11 happened, The CIA then created its own network of black sites, and instead of sending them exclusively to third countries, the CIA started taking custody of them and interrogating them on their own. So there's been a sort of continuous arc of U.S. policy toward escalating the use of assassination, although rebranding it off it as something else, and then using secret prisons, either other countries or, in the case of the first 6 or so years of the Bush administration, actual black sites run by the CIA.
Now, you talk about there's a kind of a pivotal moment as we go from the tradition of, let's call it safe, illegal or rare, I'm not sure what, of the kind of a snatch program before, to this world that we have since September 11th. And it was the case of, and I'll botch the name, Libby.
Yeah.
In 2002. Tell us about that and how he was originally treated and then what happened.
Right. I mean, you know, there's a book by a former senior FBI interrogator, Ali Soufan, called The Black Banners. And Ali Soufan tells this story about how really early after 9/11, the Clinton Doctrine was still on the books for how terrorism was viewed, which was basically a law enforcement approach. Terrorism was viewed as a crime. The Clinton folks had created what Richard Clark, the former senior counterterrorism advisor, called a almost Talmudic set of qualifications in order to actually conduct a targeted killing operation.
Or in order to never do it.
Yeah. Which is how it was viewed in the special operations community. I mean, remember Rumsfeld and Cheney, they viewed Clinton as an almost pacifist character. They viewed the CIA as a liberal debate society. I mean, they wanted to be hitting targets all the time, doing preemptive strikes against terrorists.
They worked in the Ford administration while he was signing these documents. And their view of executive power was that Congress went way too far in 1974. The Church Commission went way too far.
Oh, yeah.
And that has motivated their public life.
Of course, yeah. I mean, these guys cut their teeth at a time when the whole sort of thing was unraveling under Nixon. The CIA was coming under intense scrutiny. And you had a generation of CIA officers that had come through the ranks with an understanding that covert action is going to get you hauled in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And Rumsfeld and Cheney were big fans of executive orders and using presidential findings to get around having to go to Congress. They viewed Congress as pretty much just a funding organ. And the oversight function was only overseeing how funds were spent, but not getting involved with being briefed on covert operations. And so there was this sort of fight that happened right after 9/11 between the FBI and the CIA paramilitary division, which was being empowered by the White House to conduct really aggressive operations, where you would have actual fights over prisoners that were taken in Afghanistan or Pakistan in the early stages. And so Al-Libi was a guy who was believed to have intelligence and information about Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda network. He's originally in the custody of the FBI. The FBI agents reported that they were developing a rapport with him and that they felt that he was going to be a cooperating witness that would give them information. And just as they were sort of preparing to take him back to the United States and bring him into custody so that they could do thorough interrogations and investigation of him, the CIA comes through and takes control of him. And they then remove him to a series of black sites and torture him. And most of the FBI people that I talked to at the time, and this has come out in some of their memoirs, say that they believe that because Al-Libi was tortured and taken, that the U.S. lost a crucial opportunity early on to gain actionable intelligence that could have led to the capture of many more high-value targets that were directly involved with the 9/11 attacks. And that sort of set the tone for how things were going to go for the next several years.
It wasn't only that he was tortured, but that he was tortured to produce a specific result.
Right. I mean, these guys were trying to tie Iraq to the 9/11 attacks, the CIA, because they were under tremendous pressure from Cheney and Rumsfeld, the two primary figures who were creating the U.S. response strategy to 9/11. And they wanted, and this was not just Al-Libi, this was with many other prisoners, they wanted to get people that would say that Saddam was working with Al-Qaeda or that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. And a lot of the torture that took place early on, including when the U.S. first went into Iraq and started an extensive interrogation and detention program, a lot of the torture was aimed at retroactively proving their claims that Iraq had WMD or that there was some sort of a connection to Al-Qaeda. And I think it was Ali Soufan who said that, you know, Al-Libi at one point was so broken that he said he would just tell them anything that they wanted to hear because he just saw it as, I want the torture to stop. So if they're trying to get me to say that Saddam has something to do with Al-Qaeda, I'll say Saddam had something to do with Al-Qaeda.
And they actually used that intelligence in that way.
Right. And I mean, and, you know, Colin Powell's speech when he finally went in front of the United Nations was utterly fraudulent. And, you know, the question is, how much of it did Colin Powell actually know was false? I mean, in terms of developing his or assessing his own culpability, but certainly intelligence was being cherry-picked. You know, when you have raw intelligence, it's not been vetted. It hasn't necessarily been through the ringer with analysts whose entire careers are built on an ability to analyze whether something is legitimate, on shaky ground, part of it is true. What started happening early on is that Rumsfeld and Cheney and their guys, Stephen Cambone on the defense side, Scooter Libby on the White House side, would go and sort of sift through raw intelligence. And these guys aren't trained intelligence professionals. And they'll take little bits of something that fit their political narrative. And then they'll build an alternative intelligence dossier to the vetted CIA presentations to the White House. And they'll say, well, the CIA is trying to undermine this because they're against military action. So, Mr. President, we have this intelligence that is actionable and indicates that we need to move now on these targets, or that we have someone in custody and we need authorization to escalate our interrogation of him. And that happened with hundreds and hundreds of cases where these guys built essentially a parallel intelligence apparatus with non-professional intelligence figures, but political appointees plucking intelligence out so that it would fit their case.
We've talked about torture a little bit. One of the only real things that supporters of President Obama will say is an important difference between his record in the war on terror and George W. Bush's is that we no longer torture. So do we no longer torture?
No, I mean, I first of all, you know, there's this psychologist out in the Bay Area named Jeffrey Kay, who's done some really good analysis on the sort of shift from Bush to Obama and looking at what the Obama policy is. And he's done really good reporting on Appendix M of the U.S. Army Field Manual, which is now the standard, and has made, I think, a pretty credible argument that there are tactics that are still authorized that reasonable people would probably consider to be torture, with the forms of sleep deprivation and the use of dogs and the use of dietary manipulation, isolation, lying to prisoners, telling them things that have happened to their family members. I mean, that's a debate we should be having, but in the psychological community and the mental health professionals that had worked as part of this program, there's a school of them that say that even the minimum that Obama is saying he's doing openly is torture. But there's another layer to this that I think is more important. What I discovered when I went to Mogadishu, Somalia, is that under Obama, the United States is using a secret prison that is buried in the basement of Somalia's National Security Service, which is supported by the United States. And there are prisoners in there that have been snatched from other countries. And I tell the story of one guy in particular who was taken on orders from the United States from his home in Nairobi, was taken to Wilson Airport, and then flown to Somalia and put in this prison, which is an underground prison infested with bed bugs where no one has access to the Red Cross. In fact, I was on a show with the Red Cross and asked them about this. They said, we've never heard of the prison. And I told them exactly where it was. And we tried to follow up, and they haven't responded to us about if they've actually gone and looked at it. But this is under Obama. We have people being held in an underground prison in Somalia, and they're being interrogated by the CIA and U.S. military intelligence. Now, President Obama doesn't hold press conferences talking about that. I believe him if he says that he's shut down the CIA's black sites. But what is the real difference between having someone put in a dungeon in Somalia on your orders and then interrogated by your intelligence personnel and actually running the facility in Thailand or Poland yourself? I mean, that's how narrow the sort of divide is between what the Bush people were doing and what Obama is doing. A lot of Obama's counterterrorism policies are sort of just rebranded versions of the Bush policy. He's really trying to legitimize it, and I think he's done it successfully for a majority of liberals. They've sort of taken the whole thing whole. It's like Kool-Aid drinking when it comes to counterterrorism policy. People believe there's been this marked shift from Bush to Obama. No way. The core tenets of the program live on under Obama in a way that I think if McCain had been elected, liberals would be crying impeachment over some of the stuff that Obama has done.
Obama gave a big speech on May 23rd. It was supposed to be a big rethink on the war on terror strategy. And some people who are colleagues of yours, Jane Meyer from The New Yorker especially, responded to it like, hey, this is a major step in the right direction. You seem to be a bit more skeptical about that.
No, I disagree. I mean, Jane Meyer is one of my journalistic heroes, and I admire her tremendously. I don't agree that this represented any kind of a major shift. I think Obama's talking out of both sides of his mouth. On the one hand, you know, I think he's sincere when he says that civilian deaths are going to haunt him until the day he dies. I don't view him as some kind of callous, evil man plotting the destruction of the world or celebrating killing of, you know, civilians just because they're Muslims or something. And I do think you have some sickos in government that really, particularly after 9/11, wanted to just go and kill Muslims. And I don't think that Obama falls into that category at all. What I think is happening, though, is that he's asserting that the United States has a right to assassinate people in countries across the globe if, through some secret process, the executive branch determines they pose a threat to U.S. persons. And what I think is particularly dangerous about it is that because he's a popular Democratic president who's a constitutional lawyer by trade and won the Nobel Peace Prize, a lot of liberals have sort of checked their conscience at the door of his presidency, and they're sitting out, you know, looking in any serious way at what the actual policy is. So on the one hand, he's saying we don't want to live in a state of perpetual war. On the other hand, in the week following that speech, he authorized a drone strike in Pakistan and then authorized another drone strike in Yemen. And there may have actually been two drone strikes in Yemen. There's still lack of clarity on what's going on in the east of Yemen right now, but there's very serious fighting that the U.S. is involved with in the east of Yemen. So he's, on the one hand, he's telegraphing in a pass and saying, we don't want perpetual war. On the other hand, he is the president who's going to go down in history as having created a streamlined system to normalize assassination as a central component of what they call U.S. national security policy. And despite all the rhetoric about wanting it to be, these actions to be conducted with great care and analysis, the reality is he's still continuing to use what are called signature strikes, a sort of form of pre-crime, where in certain regions of Yemen and Pakistan, he and his advisors have deemed targeted areas totally on limits for any military-aged male gathered with a group of military-aged males. We don't even have to know the identities of the people that we are targeting for assassination anymore.
They just look from the sky as if to be of the wrong age and crowded around the wrong
time. Right,
stop and frisk with drones.
Exactly. The way I sort of see it is, you know, I think that, you know, I don't think that they're necessarily just looking for groups of military-aged males to bomb and then say they're terrorists. I do think that there's some steps taken to determine that someone in that group has some connection to terrorism. So I'll give you an example that I think is probably the most common way that this happens. You've got a guy that you're watching who attends a certain mosque, and then you start to watch other guys that go into that mosque and in Pakistan or in Yemen in certain places. And then one of the guys that you've been tracking that goes to that mosque also goes to a house that you suspect may be a place where they're manufacturing IEDs. And now you've got a lock on that guy, and you have two places that he's been where there's smoke around them. And then he's gathering with a group of other men, and you say, well, we're going to just go ahead and assume these guys must be up to no good because this guy's been at that mosque and he's been at this compound, so we're going to assume that he's engaged in terrorist activity. And so he's then with a group of other military-age males. Maybe they're sitting out having dinner. Maybe they're at a funeral. Maybe they're at a wedding. And we say, let's take this opportunity because if that guy has so much smoke around him, these guys also must be up to no good. We don't know the identity of a single one of these people. We don't necessarily have intelligence that they're involved with any plotting against the United States or any potential criminal activity, but we're going to preventively or preemptively take them out. So we kill them with a drone strike, and because they were in this certain region and they're military-aged males, we'll posthumously declare that they were militants or terrorists. Hence the phrase suspected militants or suspected terrorists that journalists repeat it all the time. I'm guilty of having done it, and I hate it.
Every single drone Yemen story starts off
suspected militant. Yeah. What is a suspected militant? You know, I mean, is that now a death penalty offense to be a suspected militant? We've got suspected militants in the United States.
Do we have a sense of how many signature strikes there have been?
No, and part of it is because the state of oversight under the Obama administration, it's hard to believe, I think at times has been worse than it was when Bush and Cheney were in office. I mean, I talked to members of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees who described to me what the state of oversight is like on the kill program. And I think, you may know this, but I don't think most Americans understand this, which is incredible. Certain senators, not all, certain senators on the Intelligence Committee are allowed to go to a secure classified intelligence facility. And they had to fight to get the chance to do this under Obama. They go to a secure classified intelligence facility. They're not allowed to bring in writing utensils. They can't bring in paper. They can't bring in anything with a battery. And they are allowed to look at certain memos that the White House, in secret, has cleared for them to look at. Even though these are people by law who are not just allowed to, but responsible for overseeing covert operations. So they're given a redacted set of documents, basically, from the White House. And they look at those, and then they're not allowed to tell anyone what they've seen. So I'll sit in an interview, like in our film, I'm interviewing Ron Wyden. And Ron Wyden, senator from Oregon, has been tough on this issue from Bush to Obama and has fought the Obama White House. And he said to me, it's as though there are two laws in America. There's one law that reasonable people would read and come to a conclusion of how to interpret that law. And most reasonable people would interpret it roughly the same way. And then there's another law, which is how the White House has interpreted that same law in secret. And he said the American people would be shocked if they could see the difference between what they believe a law says and how it's been interpreted by the president and his advisors in secret. And I said, well, can you share the difference? He said, no, I'm not allowed to. So that's a pretty chilling reality. And we got a little flavor for that when this Department of Justice white paper was leaked. And we saw in it that that these DOJ lawyers had redefined the term imminent in such a way that no reasonable person would agree with their definition of imminent, that having been involved with past plots against the United States means that you always represent an imminent threat. And that right. And imminence doesn't have to be linked to a temporal time, sense of a threat, that you don't necessarily have to be posing an imminent threat. It's that your very essence has become an imminent threat. And so therefore, we're engaged in this grotesque form of pre-crime under Mr. Constitutional Law Professor President Obama, that if McCain was asserting the right to bump U.S. citizens off without even charging them with a crime, when they're not on a battlefield shooting at American troops, I think you would have seen a lot more controversy about it. I also think the fact that the Americans that they killed were Muslims is part of why people don't care. I think if it was John Smith that was being bumped off in Yemen, I think there would have been more outrage about it, or at least more questions being asked.
Anwar al-Awlaki,
yeah.
Not the world's most friendly fella by the time he was bumped off. He was, beginning around 2009, he was making some pretty incendiary comments about killing Americans. You argue pretty persuasively, and he's a thread throughout the book, and it's very fascinating sort of attempt at humanizing that family and everything that they went through. There hasn't been any persuasive links that he was involved in terrorism, period. He was a... What is your argument about him
right.
administration claims yeah. about him?
You know, Anwar al-Awlaki, I'm sure people remember seeing him on these YouTube videos, and there was a lot. When the Christmas Day bombing plot happened, when this deranged young Nigerian guy, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, tried to blow up the plane over Detroit, there was this flurry of media reports about Anwar al-Awlaki, this American-born cleric who was hiding in Yemen or was in Yemen at the time, being involved with it. And you could go online then and you could see videos of Anwar al-Awlaki in a camouflage jacket in front of a black flag calling for armed jihad against the United States, calling on young Muslims to conduct attacks in the United States or in other countries where they lived, or to come and join the Mujahideen in Yemen or Somalia or Afghanistan and fight against the United States. And he was a guy that was openly calling for attacks against the United States. He wasn't always that man. And what I try to explore in the book and in the film is, how does someone end up on a YouTube video like that and end up on the U.S. kill list, being the first American citizen that we know to be targeted for assassination under President Obama? Well, Anwar al-Awlaki was a guy who grew up in the United States for the first part of his life, then went back to Yemen with his father, who was a government minister and was a Fulbright scholar, actually. And his parents are I know them very well. They are not their son. I mean, they're very upstanding people and who actually have quite serious admiration for the United States. It was why they wanted to come here in the first place. But Anwar al-Awlaki, their eldest son, was a guy who first was politicized by the Gulf War in 91 when he was a college student in Colorado. He was not a particularly religious guy, but became religious after the Gulf War, and his life took a different direction. He ended up becoming an imam. On 9/11, he was the imam at a large mosque in Falls Church, Virginia, the Dar al-Hijra Religious Center, and was actually on TV a lot. He was profiled by the Washington Post for a piece about Ramadan. He was on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on Talk of the Nation.
He was the face of modern Muslims.
Yeah, because he was condemning 9/11 attacks and saying that al-Qaeda had perverted Islam. At the same time, he was saying, look, there shouldn't be a war against Islam, and Muslims shouldn't be targeted by the FBI in the way that our communities are being targeted. And he was dealing with hate crimes that were being committed against Muslims and attacks on Muslim businesses. And, to make a long story short, he ends up deciding he's going to leave the United States. He's being interrogated repeatedly in private by the FBI. The FBI was trying to flip him to have him be an informant. It's quite possible that at a point in his life, he actually was working with the FBI. I mean, to me, it's a very gray area. He was such an accepted member of American society after 9/11 that he was invited to a luncheon at the Pentagon and actually gave a lecture at the Pentagon. And to give you a sense of how bad their intelligence was, they served a bacon sandwich at the luncheon that al-Awlaki was. They had no WMDs, and they didn't quite know not to serve the bacon sandwich to the imam who's coming to speak about the state of Islam in the world. But as the war spread, and we have Iraq happening and Abu Ghraib, and then Guantanamo is sort of festering on, he starts to become radicalized and ends up... recording sermons. He already was sort of, his CDs were popular around the world, but his sermons used to be of a theological nature. Now they become much more sharp political condemnations of the United States. He hasn't crossed a line yet, you know, but he's starting to flirt with the idea that people should fight against the United States. His sermons start popping up, and this is in like 2005, 2006, start popping up in terror investigations in Canada, Britain, the United States, meaning that young people, plots that are busted up, they're finding Awlaki's CDs on these things. So in 2006, Awlaki is in Yemen, attending a mosque there and going to some classes, and he's arrested on charges that he's intervened in a tribal dispute. And he believed very firmly that the United States had put him in prison. So he spends 18 months in a Yemeni prison, 17 of them in solitary confinement. What I discovered in my reporting is that it was John Negroponte, who was the director of national intelligence at the time, who told the Yemeni government that the U.S. wanted Awlaki put in prison for 4 or 5 years so that young Muslims would forget about him.
John Negroponte, who was a character in the Iran-Contra days, of course.
Right, and knows a lot about dirty wars. I mean, he was in Honduras, you know, as one of the main people helping to fuel the Contra War in nearby Nicaragua, and would write these reports from Honduras that would make, you know, the junta there seem like, you know, some kind of a Swiss human rights committee instead of being murderous thugs. And you know, Negroponte then under Bush becomes the first head of you know, this director of national intelligence, and tells the Yemenis to put one of his own citizens, Anwar Awlaki, who was an American, in this prison. So he's held in this prison for 4 or 5 years. Tremendous pressure on the dictator of Yemen internally to release Anwar Awlaki, so he ends up getting sprung and comes out of prison a totally changed man. Creates a blog, and the internet becomes his mosque. And he starts really crossing a line and saying, you know, that the U.S. should be fought, and he's sort of painting a world where the United States and Israel are in a war against Islam, and he's celebrating victories of any Islamic movement around the world, and answering questions from people about is suicide bombing acceptable under the teachings of the Quran, and the U.S. is putting all this pressure on the Yemeni government to rearrest Anwar Awlaki, and the intelligence services are constantly surveilling the home. So Awlaki decides to leave Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, and he goes to their family's tribal area in the south of Yemen, this place called Shebwa. And eventually the head of Yemeni intelligence comes to his father, who's this upstanding guy, and says, look, if you don't get Anwar to go back into the prison, the Americans are going to kill him with a drone. This is before the underwear bomb plot. This is before any allegation has been made that Awlaki is involved with terror plots. It was simply his speech that the United States was trying to stop. I haven't seen anyone make an allegation that he was involved with a terror plot prior to this. What seals his fate, though, is two things. One, Major Nadal Hassan, he was an army psychiatrist, opens fire in Fort Hood, Texas, on his fellow soldiers and kills 13 of them in November of 2009, and wounds scores of others, and is paralyzed himself in the operation. And it emerges that Awlaki had been in email touch with him. Awlaki was in email touch with hundreds of people around the world, and when in U.S. intelligence investigated it, they said that there was no evidence to suggest that Awlaki was involved with that plot. The story persists to this day. In fact, you can go online and read stories where people are saying that he was behind it, that he directed it. I haven't seen any evidence to suggest that he was. I don't know. Maybe there's stuff I haven't seen. But law enforcement and intelligence, the only on-record statements about him are that they didn't see anything in those emails to indicate he had something to do with it. But the reason I'm going to lengths to tell you this is because the next day, Awlaki publishes a blog post that says Nadal Hassan was a hero and says that we need more Nadal Hassans and that Muslims in the military should kill non-Muslim soldiers to prevent them from committing war crimes in Afghanistan or Iraq. Then you have the underwear bomb plot, which Awlaki also praised. And then it emerges that Awlaki had met with Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, this young Nigerian guy. Awlaki said that he didn't have anything to do with the plot, but that he supported it. And that put him on the kill list. So January 2010, Washington Post reveals for the first time that Anwar Awlaki and three other Americans are on the U.S. kill list. And from that moment until September of 2011, Awlaki was underground and on the run and being hunted by the U.S. And there were upwards of a dozen drone strikes aimed at trying to kill him.
Which killed other people or fell harmlessly or both?
That's interesting. There was a strike, one of the early strikes against Anwar Awlaki at the end of 2009 ended up killing a number of innocent people. In one of the other strikes, there were these two guys who were affiliated in some way with Al-Qaeda that had come to bail Awlaki out, and they ended up getting killed and Awlaki escaped. So I don't know the answer to your question, and I try to be very careful in talking about when civilians were killed and when they weren't. What I do know is that the first strike President Obama authorized against Yemen on December 17th, 2009, was not a drone strike. It was a cruise missile attack on what they believed was an al-Qaeda training camp. And they end up hitting a Bedouin village and killing 46 people, 14 women and 21 children. And I went to Abyan province where this missile strike happened, and we videotaped the cruise missile parts, very clearly showing that it was a U.S. attack. And the U.S. used cluster bombs on this village, which are like flying landmines that most countries around the world consider them banned under international law, but the U.S. doesn't recognize certain conventions. So the U.S. hasn't signed on to that convention, continues to use these flying landmines, basically. And shredded these people in the pursuit of one guy that they claimed was an al-Qaeda figure. And it's unclear that that guy even had any operational role in it. I mean, part of the problem here is that when you're engaged in pre-crime, you no longer have the burden of actually proving that the people you call enemies are enemies. And that's the world we live in right now. So we don't even know how many people we've killed. I don't know if innocent people were killed in the pursuit of Anwar al-Awlaki. I don't know that Anwar al-Awlaki was guilty of anything that he was charged with, because he wasn't actually charged with a crime. Like, I'm willing to concede, for the sake of argument, on a moral or legal level, that Anwar al-Awlaki is guilty of every single thing that the administration has leaked about him or that the president said in his speech, that he was actively involved with the Christmas Day plot, that he was plotting to poison water supplies in the United States, that he spent every waking moment of his life thinking up plots or ways to kill Americans. The question for me becomes then, how do we as a society respond to one of the most reprehensible of our citizens? Do we just sentence them to death without some kind of a process? This isn't a guy who has a sniper rifle pointed at a crowd full of people. This is a guy in the middle of Nowheresville, Yemen, who I believe we probably could have hunted down and found. And they have him isolated in this house. I think we probably could have apprehended him. So for me, the question is, why was his death so important that we didn't even bother seeking an indictment against him? President Obama's the one who said that if he had his chance, he would have prosecuted Anwar al-Awlaki. Really? Then why didn't you ever seek an indictment against him? It's incredible. If you're hunting the guy for, let's say, 2 full years, why at some point in that didn't you say, here's the charge against him, we want him extradited, and if you don't extradite him, the United States is going to take unilateral action against you. Osama bin Laden was indicted. The guys who were involved with blowing up the embassies in 98 were indicted. We have terrorists that have been put through our system in this country. Nadal Hassan, who killed 13 U.S. soldiers, he's getting a trial. John Walker Lind, who took up arms against the United States, was given access to the civilian justice system. When do we just start sentencing people to death without charging them with crimes? I mean, that to me is the issue about al-Awlaki. He said things I find reprehensible. And I think he probably was involved with, some nefarious thinking against the United States. Was he actually an operational member of al-Qaeda? I don't know. I'd like to see that evidence. I'm not saying he wasn't.
Obama intervened personally to keep a Yemeni journalist in jail.
Yeah, this to me is a shameful. I bookend my book. Well, on the front end of my book, I say that, the book is dedicated to journalists who are imprisoned for doing their jobs and those who die in pursuit of the truth. And then the last line of my book is that this Yemeni journalist, Abdullah Haider Shaya, is in prison in part because of the intervention of President Obama, and he should be set free. The short story version of this story is that after Obama started authorizing the bombing of Yemen in December of 2009, the U.S. had engaged in this conspiracy with the Yemeni government to cover up the U.S. role and for Yemen to take responsibility or credit for the attacks that the United States was going to start conducting. We know that because of the WikiLeaks cables, the meetings between General Petraeus, who was at the time was the CENTCOM commander, and the Yemeni president. So this first strike happens that Obama's authorized on Yemen. The Yemeni government puts out a press release saying that Yemen air forces have attacked this al-Qaeda base and killed 34 terrorists, and then the U.S. sends congratulations to Yemen. But Yemen had nothing to do with it. It was all a U.S. cruise missile attack. The first person to go and report on the fact that there were these U.S. munitions used that Yemen doesn't possess was this guy, Abdullah Haider Shaya, who was a journalist that was doing very serious reporting on the rise of al-Qaeda in Yemen and was interviewing al-Qaeda leaders and doing actually quite critical interviews with al-Qaeda people, far more critical than anything we see in the White House press corps of the President of the United States. So this guy is interviewing al-Qaeda leaders. He's exposed a U.S. missile attack. Soon after that, he gets abducted by Yemen's U.S.-backed intelligence service, taken to an interrogation center and beaten, and told that if you don't stop talking about the American bombing in Yemen, we're going to put you back in here for good. And so he immediately leaves that first abduction, goes on Al Jazeera and says, I've been snatched And I'm going to, you know, and it's because they want me to stop talking about the fact that America is now bombing Yemen, and I'm going to continue to report on this. And he did. He continued to report on it. And he interviewed Anwar al-Awlaki at a time when the CIA apparently couldn't find him. And because of his interviews with al-Awlaki, we know that al-Awlaki praised the underwear bomber. And he did a very, I encourage people to look at it, he did a very critical interview with al-Awlaki where he's saying, why is it that you're praising an attempt to down an airliner full of civilians? How can you say that's a military target? I mean, can you imagine being that journalist sitting here with this guy and you're not just lobbing softballs at him, you're asking him real questions. So this is why I'm so outraged about this. So he's doing all this reporting. He provided photographs to human rights organizations of the munitions that definitively proved, after they were analyzed by munitions experts, that the only party that could have conducted these bombings was the United States. So now the world knows the United States is conducting a bombing campaign in Yemen. Eventually, Abdulela Haidershaya is taken in a night raid on his home, disappears for 34 days, and then he is hauled into a special tribunal that has been set up by the dictator of Yemen to prosecute journalists for crimes against the state. And he's brought in a cage, and they charge him with being an al-Qaeda facilitator. And they present all this trumped up evidence against him. They fabricate documents saying he's involved with all these plots. Every major human rights and media freedom organization in the world condemned his trial and condemned the tribunal that he was being prosecuted in. In fact, he refused to even put on a defense because he said, I'm not going to recognize the court. And you know, there's this video of him in the cage saying that the only reason I'm here is because I exposed the cruise missile attacks that the United States did against Yemen, and that this is what happens when you do real journalism in Yemen and you're not a sycophant for the regime. So they sentenced him to 5 years in prison. Huge outcry in Yemen and outside of Yemen from the human rights and media community, media freedom community, not other journalists. All this pressure, and then the dictator of Yemen decides, well, I'm going to release Abdulela Haidershaya. I'm going to issue a pardon, not say that he's not guilty, but I'm going to pardon him over his crimes. And it leaks in the Yemeni press that the dictator of Yemen is going to pardon Abdulela Haidershaya. That day, he gets a phone call from the White House, not from some undersecretary or, you know, some assistant to the president. President Obama personally calls him and says that the United States is deeply concerned about reports that you're going to release Abdulela Haidershaya. The pardon is then ripped up, and he remains in prison to this moment when I'm talking to you. The White House, just in the first few days of June, told my colleague Ryan Grimm at the Huffington Post that it remains the White House's position that he's dangerous and should be kept in prison.
Wow.
So this is we're in an environment where the Associated Press had its phone records seized, not just on one or two reporters, but on, you know, dozens of phone lines, where there were these the attempt to imply criminal conduct was committed on the part of James Rosen, this Fox News journalist. You have whistleblowers that are being targeted by this White House in record numbers, and you have the President of the United States, constitutional law professor, Nobel Peace Prize winner, keeping a respected Yemeni journalist in prison, seemingly because he committed the crime of doing actual journalism. And the thing to me that's sort of outrageous, outrage upon outrage, is that none of the big U.S. media outlets that he did work for that were happy to run his content, the Washington Post, ABC News, NBC News, none of them have said a thing about his case. That's shameful. You know, I never worked with him at all. But I try to bring him up every day of my life because there's something so fundamentally rotten when the most powerful man in the world can keep a journalist in Yemen in prison without ever having to present a piece of evidence that he was involved with anything except responsible journalism.
Church Commission kind of is an interesting root of a lot of things. It's the root of the Cheney-Rumsfeld theory of executive power, right, which then sort of swings the pendulum back over here beginning after 9/11. Do you see any kind of political winds that suggest maybe the pendulum can start swinging back here, or have the sort of locked-in gains from Obama over Bush kind of created a system that can't even come back this way? Is there any reason to hope politically or societally that we can change the conversation?
I think the Obama presidency has been devastating for the cause of accountability or trying to rein in a kind of out-of-control counterterrorism, or what's called the counterterrorism machine. I actually think we're going to inspire more acts of terrorism than we are preventing them through our policies. It would require an entirely different set of lawmakers. If you look at the recent hearings where they were discussing drones or discussing targeted killing, you have Al Franken returning to just being a comedian instead of a lawmaker, and getting into this whole thing about how we need a drone court where then, you know, judges apparently are going to be, what Al Franken wants apparently is for judges to then review targets and decide when it's legal. It will still be in secret, but you take it out of one branch of government and put it into the other branch of government. I mean, that's the extent of the debate. The debate we need to be having is, are we creating more new enemies than we are killing terrorists with our policy? Who have we actually killed? Do an assessment of that. Who are we in bed with politically around the world? These dictatorships that we prop up, unsavory security forces that we're supporting. You know, drones are just one part of this. I have a much deeper concern about the Obama administration's support for human rights abusing military forces around the world. I think that's gonna come back to hit us too. When we're funding and beefing up militaries in Africa and the Arabian Peninsula in the name of fighting terrorism, those forces can easily be used for domestic repression of their own citizens. And I mean, there's going to be blowback from all of this. So you're asking a question about lawmakers. I mean, we would need a totally different set of people there that actually cared about these issues. And that's true on a variety of issues. It's true about our civil liberties at home. It's true about media freedoms. I mean, you know, the fact that Rand Paul was the guy who stood up, and I supported him in doing it, who stood up and filibustered John Brennan's nomination, says a lot about where we are. Where are all these serious Democrats who believe in civil liberties? Where are the people that originally were against John Brennan because of his statements on torture? They're nowhere. So I give, I don't agree with Rand Paul on much in the world, but I give him a lot of credit for having the spine to stand up and say, for one day, we are going to stop business as usual. And he read into the record serious reporting. For the first time ever, said the names of U.S. citizens who'd been killed in operations authorized by President Obama. But the fact that it's someone like him doing it instead of Democrats who spent so much time under the Bush era condemning these very same things says a lot about how bankrupt Congress is on this and other issues.
Well, on that cheery note, I think
we'll
close up. The name of the book and the documentary is Dirty Wars. Jeremy Scahill has been our guest. For Reason TV, I'm Matt Welsh. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks, Matt.